First thing I want to say this morning is that not everything that I say will be useful to you. Even if it were, you can only handle two or three main items per workshop. And so I just assume you didn't write notes furiously. I would rather you would stop and think if there's something that hits you and strikes you that you could use at this time in your life and your responsibility, that you make a note of that and specific application and let the rest go. Otherwise, it'll do like it has with mine. It'll be nice in your drawer somewhere, hoping someday to get to it. And if you don't get rid of it, then your children will have to after you've died. I am going to ask you at the end what two or three things you have picked out. So there will be an accountability at the end of this time. And either you got to get sick between the sessions or speak up, one of the two, leave. The last thing my wife told me as I left home is tell it like it is. And I'm wrestling with that. How much do I tell it like it is? But let's start with me. Last Thanksgiving, 22nd, I turned 70. And for months there had been secret meetings going on, phone calls, family get-togethers, which I was not allowed to attend, which culminated in a time at the Pink House, catered by our terrific cook and some others, that proved to be the most memorable, rewarding day of my entire life. The setting made it different, or significant, for one reason. Because about 2 years after I became president of the Navigators, my family and I moved into the Pink House for a couple of years. And all of our children, six of them, have fond memories of the days in the Pink House, except Lucy. She didn't like all the field mice that kept coming, and she is prejudiced against rodents, I'm sorry to say. And the other thing was that the kids were too scattered. To check up on them, you have to walk half the length of a football field from one bedroom to the other. But we had fond memories. Among other things, they gave me money for a watch. And the one I had had been giving out. So I went down and checked on watches. And I went to a watch store downtown. And I asked about Rolexes. He said, well, a garden variety Rolex begins at $900. I said, $900? Oh, yes. He said, they're lifetime watches. Well, I said, at my age, I'm not really interested in a lifetime watch. I wonder if I can make some arrangements to rent one. Then I told him that old story about the green bananas that you all heard, about the old man that said at his age he didn't even buy green bananas. He might not live till they ripened. So that's telling it like it is. People talk about signs of the Lord's soon coming. I see increasing signs of my soon going. So in either case, there'll be a meeting relatively soon. And maybe sooner than some of us think. And we better be ready. Glen Eyrie is an emotion, not just a place. It's an emotion. To many people, it's a positive emotion. To some of us, it's a negative emotion. I include myself in the latter. This beautiful place is the biggest headache I ever had as president of the Navigators. The first 10 years, it was so bad that I moved, that I had an office on the Glen, and whenever I came in the gate, a cloud of depression would come over me. And I moved my office off the Glen into town for a year and a half so I didn't have to drive through the gate. I said Glen Eyrie is an emotion. very positive to most people who've come here. Thousands have been blessed. But to some of us who've been responsible to see that it ends in the black, there's been pain. That's like it is. Then there came quite a few years in there. It was a lot of fun. I didn't have the direct responsibility for it anymore. That was part of it. And then I think of this beautiful, beautiful sight. But that's what it is. It's a sight. It's as beautiful as I've seen anywhere in the world. And as I look around and see what's done, it's taking good care of it. But the heart of this place is not the rocks, the lawn, the furnishings. The heart of the place is its people. And it's an emotion to people who work here or who have worked here. And with some, it's a mixture. I think in the main, positive. But for some reason or other, while we have, I think, fairly good security down at the gate, we've never figured out a way to keep the devil out of Glen Eyrie. We can keep people out even once and occasionally. We hear people scream, even our friends out. But not the devil. I remember I used to hear, I don't hear it anymore, and if I do, I'm very intolerant of it. The people working in Glen Eyrie ought to get out in the real world. Well, if this is not the real world, I don't know what is. The real world is wherever I happen to be at the moment. There I am as a sinner. There I am with the devil. There I am with the responsibility to do. It's as real as any real world gets. And I think it's very shallow, and it's gotten to be a hot button with me. I don't even want to hear it anymore. And besides, any place God puts you is a real world. And if God has put you here right now, this is it for you. And I'll have more to say about that a little bit longer. Now, I want to be kind and nice, but I wish Lucy hadn't said, tell it like it is. See, I'm chairman of the board of directors, have been 35 years, been trying to get out of it for 5 years. Part of my job is to look at the bottom line. And we're having a struggle right now. If you don't know that, I'll tell you. Also, there are little studies going on. What should the Glen do in the future? What should be its future? Where does it fit in the 90s? When we first started, there weren't places to be had. Now, there's all kinds of competition. All kinds of conference places, college campuses, they want to rent their facilities to help make ends meet. We've got all kinds of motel chains that are competing and so on. So it's a different day, and it's tougher. And you might say, well, why tell me this? Bob Sheffield needs to know that. Well, it affects you. Now, if I didn't have a solution for this, I wouldn't be telling you. I believe that God gave us this place, and no doubt about it. And I'm the only guy who seriously thought of selling it about 15, 20 years ago. I'd have been glad to get rid of it. I told Lucy the other day, I said, maybe we ought to give it to Dobson. She said, I hope you'll take it so slowly that you gather dust. In fact, she intimated that if I participated in anything to no longer have Glen Eyrie part of the Navigator, she would divorce me. I said, Glen Eyrie is an emotion. And it's a strong one and a good one. So it's more than it is a place, but it's an emotion. Donald McGilchrist tells me that there are people overseas who've never been here, but who feel like this is the Navigator Mecca. And I think that some of us who work here, I drive to work every day over there at the other office. You work around the place, and people come aboard here, and I think we fail to remember, we do forget how meaningful this is to a lot of people who come. In trying to analyze what the Lord wants me to do in the future and realizing that it takes me 4 times longer to adjust to jet lags, and I pretty well decided to leave that to the next generation, all the overseas travel. I realize that one full-time career, when I get to the place where if I'm still mentally alert, but I have to be wheelchaired, I'd just like to have a spot down here in the dining room and let me spend a few hours every day and just talking to people, and you could have a global ministry and never leave this castle. And I mean an effective global ministry. And you would actually impact the world right here from this place. So in some of the difficulties we have, whether it's managing or the financing or so on, we mustn't forget the vision of this place. Now, so I'm going to talk about that a little bit too. We changed subjects a couple times, and we thought, well, I talk about laboring, and that's my thing these days, winning the lost and building the saved. But I'm going to talk about leadership, and some of this will not be new to you, but if you remember what I said, well, it must have been pretty good. It won't hurt to hear it again. And if you don't remember it, why, you need to hear it again. So, but I think of Glen Eyrie not only as an emotion, but it's a place, it's a facility, it's a tool. And I've often thought of it as a cave, a Adullam. 1 Samuel 22:2-2. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam. His young man, still in his 20s, because he became king when he was 30, so he's still in his 20s. He escaped to the cave Adullam, and when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. That was the Glen Eyrie of the day. They got together with him, joined him there, this cave, this place. And you, of course, I can't bring anything new to people like Leadership Development Institute folks and old-time navigators like you are, but review anyway. But you remember verse 2, the kind of people that came. They wouldn't have passed the screening committee of a personnel board, or the front office that screens applications, because it says, and everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented, at least they had one thing in common. That all starts with D's. Distressed, in debt, and discontented. Now, how would you like to have gathered around you and your crew that kind of a gang? Maybe you think you've got one, but I know you don't. But that's not too hopeful to begin with, is it? Now, I'm going to, this is kind of fun for me. I hope it is for you. So I'm going to digress, and that's dangerous because I may never get through my notes. And I did actually work hard. I got these notes boiled down. If I stick with them, everything will be okay, but I'm not going to stick with them. It comes to looking for people, personnel. You know, I tell people, you should do that like the way an Indian walks through a forest. When he starts out through the forest, I'm told, he doesn't start by looking out there. He starts by looking right where his next step is, lest he step on a snake or in a hole. And then he keeps looking out in ever-widening circles. The guy that lives on the East Coast or gal looks a lot better than the one who works on our crew here, because we don't see their warts. We don't see the weaknesses. So we step over and around this person who's kind of a little aggravating to us to get to somebody else out there that looks pretty well perfect until they get next to us, and then we find out there are no perfect people. And especially starting with me. So we're looking for something better or bigger in our context than the perfect person to start with. We're looking for the kind of people that have a heart that's willing to follow God and let Him work on them, change them. Now, I know if you're the supervisor of a crew, you had some and you got them to the place just about where they're really good, and then he went off somewhere, and then you start with somebody new, and you think, oh, boy, I've got to go the same routine all over again. Well, that comes back to what's your vision, what's your calling? Is it to build lives or to maintain the lawn? Are you building lives in the context of maintaining the lawn or putting up meals? What is your vision? Now, it's hard to keep a vision clear because the very pressure of your do list blurs it. And even if you don't have a do list, it blurs it. But I'm jumping ahead here. But so here are the kind of people that came, gathered together. And he became a captain over them. He accepted them as his team, his crew. And there were with him about 400 like that. Not the kind of job I would have looked for. But you look, later on he became king. And over in 2 Samuel 23, we read about some of those guys. These be the names of the mighty men. Distress, debt, discontented. Now how are they described? Mighty men. And it picks out some of those and describes them to us. This one here, the Tachmonite that sat in the seat, chief among the captains, this guy lifted his spear up against 800 whom he slew at one time. Quite a man. In debt, distress, discontented, some transformation took place somehow. And after him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite, one of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines that were gathered together to battle, and the men of Israel were gone away, and he arose and smote the Philistines until his hand was weary, and his hand clave to the sword. He kept swinging that sword till he couldn't let go. I'm in 2 Samuel 23, starting with verse 8, 9, now we're in coming up to 10. And the Lord wrought a great victory that day, and the people returned after him only to spoil. And after him was another guy. And the people fled from the Philistines, but he stood his ground, and he defended that ground against these Philistines. Distress, debt, discontented, a motley crew, mighty men. What made the difference? I think what made the difference was leadership, was association with David, who was God's mighty man. That's what made the difference. Now, Glen Eyrie, I think, is a cave of Adullam that has turned out and can turn out and will turn out mighty men and women of God. May not look all that promising when first they come. If they were too well developed, they wouldn't need to come here. We just need a few like that to help the others. So I think of it as a cave of Adullam. And the key is leadership. Now you're the leaders, right? The key is not Terry Taylor and the U.S. leadership team or Lauren Sanney, the chairman of the board. We're not the key to Glen Eyrie. You're the key to Glen Eyrie and Bob Sheffield. And your crews. You know, I can tell a lot about Glen Eyrie by the people on the gate. I can tell you when we change managers. I can tell you whether they're tight or loose, whether they're trained or not trained. I admit that the gatekeeper can have their ups and downs. But there are just other ways that I can tell how we're doing in Glen And the people who come here tell by not me sitting over in the third floor office where they didn't want to walk up to anyway because it's too strong, big a climb. They put us tough people up on the third floor. No, it's who they see, the hojos, the kitchen, the servant, the gals, and that's the heart of this place. Yeah, the mountain sheep is a curiosity. That's quite a sight. But it doesn't make people like that. I said the key is leadership. One of the times back there, those first 10 years, we had a training program going on. And I mean, I'll tell you, it was sad. People left here angry, frustrated. Started out with frustration. And that started with disappointed expectations. And I think partly we were at fault because we had false expectations given in the first place. And frustration is disappointed expectations. That's happened with some LDIers who've come. Apparently there wasn't a communication as clear as to what to expect. And they had maybe the idea that it was going to be like a seminary. Or you have different ideas. That's why it's so important to clarify expectations when you start. Yeah, I'm jumping around here. That's because I'm 70 and it's harder to keep your thoughts. So, and so that summer, I mean, people left here aggravated, angry. They were sour toward the Lord, toward Christianity, toward the Navigators. And over in Maranatha, North Platte, Nebraska, that conference ground's flat alongside the river. No beautiful scenery like this. Mosquitoes. Poor food. And all the rest. And all the contrast in the world. And we had a training program there, and people would leave that training program, left that training program, absolutely high on the Lord, high on the Navigators, all excited about things. And what was the highlight of the summer? Well, when the Platte River overflowed, and we spent all night putting sandbags out there. And the leaders were there with us. And I began to do a little ad hoc examination of that. You know what the difference was? See, this place had all going for it that North Platte, Maranatha didn't. As far as scenery, weather, absence of bugs, heat, all the rest. The difference was leadership. In those days, the same people that worked in the office tried to lead the training program, but they went home at night. They had families. And we were overloading the leadership. And so the trainees were here by themselves from 5 o'clock in the evening to 8 o'clock the next morning. Over in Maranatha, they lived and worked and fought the river and slapped the mosquitoes together. And I saw the difference was leadership. That's what made the difference. Leadership. So I thought, you can have the most beautiful place, best kept, and all the rest. But that's okay just to make a little tour around and go, ooh, oh, and ah. But to stay there for a while and work, that's not enough. It takes the right kind of leadership. So that's the key. Well, some of you know that I put on a card, maybe most of you know, all I know about leadership. Or someone said, you get this in your head and you'll have it in a nutshell. I mean, it's really boiled down. I wouldn't say that to you either. But would you? Oh, my old jokes. You know, that's one nice thing about having grandchildren. You know, they haven't heard all my old stories, and they're new to them, so that's kind of fun. Take one here, and the ones that left over, give them back to me, because they cost me a quarter apiece. Merry Christmas to you. I won't charge you for it. All I know about what leaders do. Now, I know something else about leadership that's not on here. And that has to do with leadership capacity or what to do when your best is not enough. But no use talking about that until we review what leaders do. I'm talking about everybody here. men, women, and maybe some of you, maybe some of you sitting here, you don't actually have a crew that reports to you. You're still a leader. And what I have to say applies to you. See, because everybody ought to make a difference. There ought to be something that happens in Glen Eyrie, some little plus factor that happens here that wouldn't happen if you weren't here. You're not just part of the thing. You are part of something, but you also add something extra because of who you are, what you are, what your convictions are, what your experience is. So every person here should add something that would be missing if you weren't here. It may be small, but it'll be something that nobody else can. Yeah, because we're different. And that's what enriches the place. So what I have to say is to all of us. Now on that card, it's if you kind of fold it there, so the definition or description is on the front, and then there's a verse of scripture on the back. And I'll look through it, then I'm going to go over it. On the front, after years of thinking about it, studying, and plagiarizing, I came up with this description of what I think leaders do. Leaders bring vision, faith, and courage to coordinated effort. When a leader walks on the scene, things perk up. I remember when Howard Johnson was still in existence over there in the Garden of the Gods Road, I had a Bible study there with some businessmen. Hadn't been there a couple times, and I said, you know, this place is going to shut down in a year. There's no leadership here. You can tell it at how stiff and scared the waitresses were. There was no freedom, no excitement. And I found out later why, because my own daughter worked there for a summer, and everything had to be done the Howard Johnson way, which was decided by somebody back east. So consequently, they're always out of things because they didn't let the local manager decide what local tastes were. Furthermore, they didn't train the people in such a way that people had freedom of action, make some decisions on their own, so they were stiff. And I said, there's no leadership here. You can just tell it. And it shut down. So leaders do more than manage. They do manage, but they bring vision, faith, and courage to coordinated effort, which means to manage. Now, this is the part I'm going to hammer on the most. The vision, faith, and courage. Now, on the inside it says, the vision to see what ought to be done, the faith to believe it can be done, and the courage to believe or to persevere until it is done. Now, but they also coordinate effort, therefore they manage. And when I used to go around the world, when I first started in this job, I knew that our people needed to learn to manage, so I took this book by Allen Associates on management as POLC, Plan, Organize, Lead, and Control. Well, I knew that the word control is almost like swearing in the Navigator. You don't control anybody. So I changed it to evaluate, and besides it was easy to remember, it's POLE, P-O-L-E. But even the word evaluate I find is somewhat threatening. So I, particularly if I'd be outside the U.S., third world countries, I'd start to talk about this, and they wouldn't just write out loud. It was kind of, that's American Management Association, that's Harvard Business Review, that's Peter Drucker, anything like that was down. So I try to figure out, how am I going to approach this thing? Now, I don't know whether I thought this up myself or I got it from somebody else. I must have gotten it somewhere else because it's too good to be thought up myself. It's kind of like when you study the Bible, you get a new thought, and it's so terrific, you got to check a commentary to make sure it's true. You know, as if God couldn't speak to you personally. So I thought, You know, there are four questions that every person wants to know their supervisor. Whether that person is a farm hand in Indonesia, a crew member at Glen Eyrie, or a vice president of General Motors, those are the same four questions, and they're right there. What am I supposed to do? Will you let me do it? Will you help me when I need it? And will you let me know how I'm doing? And I would find, whether I be in Indonesia or somewhere, or what were those questions again? And I'd tell them, what were those? Well, and I'd give them to them. But that has to do with planning, organizing, leading, and evaluating. Don't tell anybody that, but that's what the questions do. So that's where I came to those questions. But then, and now I'm going to start on the back. Because here we find the secret to David's transforming leadership. Because this verse is the last verse of Psalm 78. And in Psalm 78, and I won't take time to read it because I've digressed enough already, and we do quit at 11. But he had a tough job. Those are rebellious people he was trying to lead, and God gave him to lead. Just read that sometime. It wasn't a bunch of people who were ready to follow. And, this is the whole country load. And then it says in the last part of Psalm 78, verse 70, he chose David, also his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. He was a farm boy. From following the ewes, great with young, he brought him to feed Jacob, his people, the Israelites, and Israel his inheritance. And here's what he did. And I like the King James here the best, these translations on this one. So he fed them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them by the skillfulness of his hand. Now, I've heard it here time and again. Almost since the LDI started, I've had LDI guys work for me on Saturday at my home. And then we visit over lunch, and I find them asking me questions. So at least I get a little insight from the LDI, from a point of view of certain people who may or may not have a total view of it. But anyway, one of the questions that always keeps coming has to do with the balance between which comes first, the person or the task. And if there's ever a place where that's a pressure, it's here. Which comes first, the LDIer, the crew member, or the task to be begun, the conference is coming in, the thing that's got to be repaired, the work that has to be done? Which comes first? Well, I think that this verse, better than anything I have ever come across, and I'm indebted to Jack Mayall for this verse, summarizes and answers the question about the person and the task that you face, will face, always will face the rest of your life and with whoever comes. There may be some few exceptions. So, now I think this grid, some of you maybe took a course in college in management. I think it came out of the University of Illinois. And anywhere, as I say, I plagiarized it from somewhere. This is a grid. That's supposed to be 10, 1, 2. Up to 10. On this side, we have the person. Over here, the task. Which comes first? Now, we'll just kind of put quadrants in this little illustration. Which comes first? What do you think? Which comes first, the person or the task? Okay, that's one answer.
Both.
Does the task ever come before the person?
Sometimes.
If the castle was on fire, which would come first? A little committee meeting and a little luncheon over at Hungry Farmer, or would it be putting the fire out? Hungry fire. Yeah. This pain in the neck, let it burn down. Well, it depends on what you're doing, right? Now, if you're having a little party and you want to have a little get-together with your crew or the whole Glen crew, or if you happen to be at a country club, then it's very high on this side, on the person-oriented part. But if you're fighting a fire, or you got 250 people coming in and 200 just leaving, then you got to put a high priority on the task, right? So it depends on what you're doing. Now, if you have neither one, of course, then it's zilch. Then we would have the place up for sale. But the overall average, you want to be out here somewhere. Isn't that right? But it's not the same all the time. It ebbs and flows. You take time, and I know you do. Give attention to the person, one way or another, various means. You have some talks, you have little meetings, you have a little party, you have whatever. And then there are other times, friends, it's time to go to work. We'll party later. Now's the time to hit it. So if you've been hitting it for quite a while, then you think, well, we need some kind of a little break in here somewhere. Or if we've been, you see, and see what happens, if it's all person and no task, then we can be the nicest bunch of people that ever went out of business. Right? But if you're all task and no person oriented, then you can be the most efficient people who kept on losing the staff all the time. So you have to do both. And it's not the same every day. But the overall average climate has got to be a combination of both, right? I think, Dean, you wanted to ask or say something.
Well, you may come to this, but what if, for sake of cost effectiveness, the climate is to build your labor force to fit the task, and to fluctuate your labor force to fit the tasks, and how do you get the person in there? Everyone there. I think you might, maybe housekeeping, where they fluctuate the size of the crew to fit the task of the week. So they, there may be a few regulars, then there's fill-ins, so the workload is always there. You don't have the break, necessarily. Or maybe the kitchen and dining room work the same way. They bring in more to meet the need. They take away some, so people, the task is always there, or more so there than the labor force can handle.
I don't know if this is an answer or not, but you can't expect fewer people to, over a long period of time, four people do the work of eight. Anybody, any little group would be glad to work all night, and we've all done it, on occasion, to get something done. There's this breed of core, but you can't keep that up. So you've either got to get more people, or you've got to cut down the task for which you're responsible. You cannot do both over the long haul. And it says, 6 days shalt thou labor, and the seventh you shall rest, in seed time and in harvest. God has made us so that we can only handle working 6 days, and you've got to take one off. That's an overall average. And when Napoleon, after the French Revolution, went to a 10-day work week, they found out it didn't work. People wore out, so he went back to a 6-day work week. And when after the Russian Revolution, they ignored Sunday, and you know who of all people reinstated Sunday as a day of rest? Joseph Stalin. Because human beings, he didn't know this, are constituted by God, that you've got to have periodic breaks. If you don't see that they get them, then pretty soon you won't have anybody. Or you'd be visiting them at Penrose. Temporary, yeah, but then you've got to do some adjusting. Then finally it gets to the place you just can't no longer whip the tired horse. He just can't get up and pull a load anymore. It's just a fact. So now there's where leadership comes in. You've got some tough decisions to make. And you can make them. See, one time we had such a problem here on the... See, we shut down Glen Eyrie entirely for 9 months. And that's a long story. I know this place could be shut down. And it might be sometime. Now, don't let that scare you. No, nobody's going to go jump wild here. But I'm trying to say things can be done. You do not and cannot get blood out of a turnip, after so long. Maybe not ever, but you've got to change something. That's all there is to it. I say short term, yeah, you can do it. But long term, you just can't ignore the way God made us and get away with it. But it says in seed time and harvest. Now that takes faith. When it rained on Saturday or Friday, and the guy thinks now I'll clear it up and I got to plant seed on my day this day. And I don't mean be legalistic about that. I don't think it has to be Sunday. It needs to be 1 out of 7. But I don't think God ever abrogated that. But also in harvest. So that takes faith. And one thing, it breaks that cycle of the workaholic or the excessive demands. And also, it's faith. And there may be other ways of getting that job done. Maybe it doesn't have to be done. And another thing that happens, and I'm clear off again, when you get really worn out, two things happen. You get overly conscientious. And secondly, your timing gets off. You think everything has to be done now. Those are two symptoms of being pushed over the brink. Then what happens is a spiral downward. And it keeps going. And somebody, somewhere, there's where leadership's got to come in. It's got to stop. Say, whoops, hold it here. And they say, well, we can't do it. Well, I'm trying, in my illustration, I'm trying to get into, I'm more concerned about stealing your backbone this morning than I am other things. We can do that. We can make a difference. Don't tell me we can't. You'll be kind of like, well, I'm so sorry, it's all out of my control, I can't do. Yes, you can do something. When this place was in such serious trouble, and I wanted to get rid of it, that's way back there, and I said, H.J., I'm not a finance man. I got to find somebody that will help me solve this Glen Eyrie problem and its finances. He said, you don't have to be a finance man. You just need to get before God and ask him for some ideas. You're responsible, and you take it. And I went over to Lost Valley, and I stayed up all night. I can see it yet. And I'm sitting there in the bathroom on the floor, leaning up against the tub with my notebook in hand. And I wrote out before morning the steps I felt God wanted me to take. And we took every one but one, and probably should have done the one. But I know it. But you can do it. That fits you and your crew. And I'm coming to that courage. To persevere. So it's the velvet-covered brick. It's the steel on the backbone, but with a smile on the face. You can get by with murder if you have a smile on your face. So that's a long-winded answer. I have long-winded answers to short questions. But see, I'm trying to get that there's more. I like to get them away from here with the with not so much what's in your head, but what's in your soul as the leaders of this place. And so much hinges on you. I'm aware of it. Very aware of what hinges on you. And I'm trying to tell it like it is. I'm not pussyfooting around here. And I may even tell some things I'm not supposed to. But I'll take that chance. Now, come back to the grid. Let's apply. Now, I lose these things. Somebody told me, be sure not to, if I use the overhead, don't write on the wall. And I promise not to. So I might forget, and I'm going to use this. Okay. Now, take Psalm 78:72, and look how it fits. So he fed. What does that have to do with? The person. He fed them, according to the integrity of his heart, and guided. That has to do with the task. So there you have the functions of leadership, which are to feed and to guide. One has to do with the person, the other task. Now let me stop on that for a minute. You can't pour water out of an empty bucket. You can't put out to people that you lead unless you first take in. The Christian life has to do with not our doing something for God first, but letting God do something for us. It's by grace, through faith, from beginning to end. You can't be a leader to take care of your own life, your family life, your job, and lead people without some help that's available and still keep bright and not sagging all the time. Now, I thought, take Acts 22, 14, and 15. This fits whether you're a leader. It also fits in evangelism or discipling people. It says, I forgot what it said. This is where Ananias came to Paul. He said, "The God of our fathers hath chosen you, Saul or Paul. Why? That thou shouldst see that just one." Who's that? Jesus. "And hear the voice of his mouth. That thou shouldst know his will, see that just one, hear the voice of his mouth." That means take some time, right? You got to stop and do that. You don't do that on the run. Sometimes, but not. You got to have, that's sort of the exception. "For you shall be his witness unto all men of" what? "Of what you've seen and heard." Well, you can't share with others what you've seen and heard if you haven't taken time to look and listen. So if you're going to feed people, you got to get time for intake before you can put out. See, we're not reservoirs, we're channels. Let's not forget that. John 15:6, Jesus said, "If a branch abide not in me," "if a person abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered." Now, what do people do, he said, with withered branches? "And men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are" what? "Burned." Now, there's the ultimate burnout. There are books on burnout, articles on burnout. There's the ultimate burnout, right? And where did it start? A failure to abide in Christ. Cut off from our power. Cut off from the reservoir. Cut off from the power plant. So we don't go through life in your job or my job on our own. If we do, we're going to wither. Because we're talking about another dimension here. It's a spiritual dimension that goes along with us. And the thing that I try to get across to businessmen, that somebody who's effective for Christ is not somebody who does different things all day long than the businessman in the next desk. They do the same things, but with a different perspective and a different power. They've got a hidden life. One of the verses I'm living on these days is Psalm 91. "He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty." Do you have a secret place where you abide in Christ? You make sure the connection's clear. Colossians says our life is hid with Christ in God. We're not going to be the leaders that God wants us to be unless we've got some time, somewhere, for a hidden life, a secret life. A life when we get aside and say, "Lord Jesus, is everything okay between us? Is there anything that I need to make right with anybody? Is everything all right? Then you go on and you let him speak to you through his word, and then you pray. And let me just say, I've concluded that unless you say something to God, you haven't prayed. Meditation is not prayer. I don't care. I know there's some great books been written. I don't believe it. I've decided, and I've looked up the words in the Greek and the Hebrew and Aramaic and Egyptian, if it were there. Prayer is speaking out to God. You have not because you ask not. And when you leave that quiet, that place, that secret place, have you said anything? Did you ask him for anything? Did you ask him? And one thing that's part of my own quiet time, if I get cut short, one thing I do is pray through the day forwards. Pray for the first person I'm going to meet, the biggest problem I've got, what I'm going to meet mid-morning, what I'm going to meet at lunch, what in the afternoon, as far as I know, and I pray through the day forwards. And God usually gives me ideas I never would have thought of on my own. And then at night, before you go to sleep, and this is harder for me to do, I don't do it every night, but try to just to pray through the day backwards and thank him, first of all, for everything that went right. Because when you go to bed at night, you usually have two things in mind. First of all, what went wrong, and secondly, what you didn't get done. And I've decided, I got it from Leroy Imes, if God himself could look back on the day in Genesis 1 and said, look back, and he said it was good. There's nothing wrong. In fact, it's good for us to look back on the day and say, what went well? Now, I want to tell you, I'll just tell you frankly, I think, lost control of myself for about 3 days. Last week. I got so aggravated and so annoyed in a certain context that, I won't tell you what... And beyond that. And Lucy said, I think you ought to just calm down. I said, I don't want to calm down. This is a pain in the neck and it's got to stop. But I found out later, I didn't fully understand the story. So now I'm going to go back and apologize. Well, Sunday mornings, I get up a little earlier and I look back on the week. Well, I tell you, when I started that, there's only one thing that stood out in my life. Was that loss of self-control on my part. And that's all I could think of. But I determined, in fact, I went back to my schedule for the week and the do list to see what I'd scratched off. And it's amazing how much went well last week, too. So I started with listing what went well. Because otherwise, and even if you have a bad one like I did, it's okay now, I got all cleared with everybody. But... And at 70, you know, I didn't think I would have a problem with that anymore. I got news for you. It's a battle right on down to the end. Complete victory is after the resurrection, not before. But if I focus only on what went wrong, that makes me a negative person. And I'm not a thankful person. I am a gloomy person. Now, you see, a Christian is a realist. You don't stick your head in the sand, pretend it's not there. You face problems head on, you look them right in the eye. But Philippians 4:8 says, whatsoever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. And you'll be a lot more fun to be around. So, which carries on here, and boy, this is, I didn't realize I was going to press it like this. He fed them according to the integrity. That has to do with the person. That has to do with the character. That has to do with what you are, and that's what I've gotten into, and I'm illustrating. Leadership starts with character. And if you don't have that, then quit leading or get a new leader. But Everything folds if you don't have character. You can teach competence to a great degree, but if you don't have character, things will rot from the inside. And integrity is wholeness. And I think the best illustration I know of integrity is 1 Corinthians 4:15. This one's in the NIV. You keep looking around for the one that you like best, and this is what I like best. Paul tells how he's going to send Timothy, and this is 1 Timothy 4:17, and just listen to it, last part. He, Timothy, will remind you of my way of life in Christ Jesus, listen, which agrees with what I teach. That's integrity. That the way I act agrees with what I teach. And what I teach agrees with the way I act. That's integrity. That's wholeness. That makes you single-minded. Because not to be that way is to be double-minded, and that double-minded person is unstable in all their ways. So an outgrowth of this time with God, this hidden thing, the number one outgrowth should be character. Peter said in 2 Peter 1, add to your faith what? Virtue. What is virtue? That's moral goodness. That's character. And people may not agree with you. That's okay if you're a person of character. And I could give you a theological discussion. I think there are two fundamental aspects to Christian character. One is holiness, another one is love. Holiness and love. I think the two fundamental aspects of the characters of God, therefore, to be God-like is to be holy and loving. Now, so he fed them according to the integrity, that's character, and the skillfulness. I forget, is that one or two L's there, right there? Two? So there are three L's in the word. Four. Is there another L here? Oh, right. Okay. Skillfulness. That has to do with competence. Competence. Now, therein, of course, you're always working, always learning, aren't you? I was going to bring it in, but I didn't bring it. I carry a 5.5 by 8.5 half-inch ring notebook. This is my journal. And I am forever picking people's brains. Now, I do read books on how-tos. They're a great help. But one of the greatest helps I have found through the years to get know-how with the least amount of time is to get somebody, take them to lunch or have a cup of coffee, ask them questions, and I unabashedly take out my little notebook and say, do you mind if I make some notes and write them down? And then I later transfer them to my do list to practice them. And then I put little prompters on my do list of things that I need to do so that you yourself are constantly growing in your own skill, but then you can help other people in skills. Now, I don't think you have to have technical knowledge so much as knowledge of how to go about applying your technical knowledge. One time, I did an experiment just to see, way back there, I asked Jack Mayhall to manage the print shop, and he knew nothing about printing. But he was a good manager. And I wondered if a guy who didn't know the technical part could manage a print shop by hiring the people and helping them to use their expertise. And it proved my point. So I'm not saying you've got to know more than the people who work for you. You know less. But you can help them know how to apply their expertise. It has more to do with process. And that's another, I can see some questions there. But let me get on a little bit farther and I'll quit for some questions here. So there we have qualities of leadership, and then the tools, and I always keep misplacing it. There it is. heart. That has to do with the person, right? The tools of leadership are your heart and your hand. I remember one time, Bob Newkirk was the, I don't know if he was director of Lanier at that time, but I had this little team, and there were certain responsibilities that I wanted to move from this person to that person. That can be a little delicate process. And so I was using the illustration that I said, you know, it's like a hen sitting on eggs. If this hen has got too many eggs to sit on, and this doesn't have enough, see, I would just take some eggs from this hen and put it under that hen. It divides up the responsibility. That's all I'm doing here. And as this was to soften the blow, you know, of transferring some responsibilities. And Bob Newkirk says, well, I don't mind if you move the eggs as long as you have warm hands. And I thought, there's a lot of truth to that. Yeah, I thought it was a terrific illustration. You can move them, move the eggs, but have warm hands. So it's heart and hand. Give a balance to leadership. Well, so much for that. Why don't we just stop here? Any question? First thing you ought to do, well, let's have any questions for clarifications first. Any question? If not, would you look through your notes? Is there anything you've picked up thus far you could use? If so, along the margin, let's use that little old ABC system. If you think it's something really indispensable, you've got to put this into practice quickly. It's life or death. Put an A by it. That means it's indispensable. That little point or that little thought that will apply to something that you are currently involved in. I'm not talking about someday in the future, but something you, boy, I've got to remember this, or I've got to stop this, or I've got to start this, or I've got to change something. Then, or B, that means this is necessary, this is something I ought to do, but it's not life or death like this A is. And then a C simply means it's good. If I could get to it, it'd be fine, but it's certainly not in the category of these. So with whatever notes you've got and things you put down, give them a priority right now. Is A, B, or C? As to practical application at this time in your life. Okay, then circle the A's and count them up. Because I'm going to ask you how many A's you have. You ready? Need a little more time. Ready? Start over here. How many A's do you have?
Two.
How many do you have?
Three.
Don't point here. How will I do that now? Yes. Two. That's about right. In fact, this is, we ought to quit for the morning. That's about enough. You do that, and it'll be a time well worth it. But since we go to 11, Let's take a break. Let's take a
break. So you got two programs trying to...
Would you please, those A's that you have, take a look at them there, would you? And I want you to put a date right alongside of when you're going to take your first step to do something about that A. Now, today is the 11th of December. It may not be practical on the 11th, but when are you going to make your first step to do something about that A? Maybe it's after the first of the year. I don't know when, but put down a date. That takes it out of the realm of talk and commitment. Now, if you had your calendars here, the next thing I'd ask you to do is to put it on your calendar. And maybe, hi, Bob, welcome back.
Thank you.
I hope you raised some money. I think that's what you were doing, right? Okay. Or I could have brought a post-it note and just pasted it on your glasses so you wouldn't forget. Okay. Now, we're going to talk about what leaders do. They bring vision, faith, and courage. Vision. That's on the front of that card. I'm just using the same old thing here, Bob. But it's the fruition of a lifetime. It's all I know on one card. So I have no reason to change it. The big thing is to apply it. And you see, at my age, 70... When I retired as president in 1986, then the guys gave me a ministry for the business professional ministry. Asked me if I would take it. And Bob himself, I think you were on the USLT at that time. And I said, yes, but provided it includes business and professional people and it has global implications. Then the next thing, well, what is your vision for it? Your purpose? Your target, your vision. And we had a vision. I better not get into that vision. All I want to say is that God gave us a vision, and it's astounding what's happened. And I've turned it over to Roger 1st of December, and I hated like 60 to have to do it, but you got to deal with realities of life. He's doing great, but it's really something. But we want to talk about the vision of Glen Eerie. Now, visions see, or people with vision, leaders, see what ought to be done. Now, just as a simple illustration, here's a businessman. He sees a need that people have, a human need. How to meet that need as a profit, at a profit, and you have a business. Therefore, it's people of vision who provide jobs. However, the kind of vision we're talking about is bigger than that. It's vision that comes from God, grows out of our relationship with God himself and what he wants to do in this world. And for us, in the Navigators, it starts with Matthew 9:36-38. It says, and when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion. That's the heart. On them. Why? Because they were harassed and helpless. Like sheep without a shepherd. He said, the harvest is plentiful. That is not the problem. There are people still telling us, even in the Navigators, that the problem is with the harvest. It's not. It's with the laborers. See, my question is to them, is God at work in this world or is he not? Is the Holy Spirit doing his job of convicting people of sin, righteousness, and judgment, or is he not? As Leroy Iams would have put it, not only go where the fish are, but go where the fish are biting. Because that's where God is at work. And so they're close to the shore, bite them, I mean, catch them. And when you run out of those, then they launch out deeper. And the world's full of them. And my prayer has been, and here I am, isolated on the third floor of What's the new name of our place over there? National Services
Center.
Yeah. I always go in the back door, so I don't know what it is coming in the front door. And some of you know I got an old joke that I keep telling that I like every navigator to remember. It's about the admiral who went to work every morning, unlocked the center drawer of his desk, pulled out a piece of paper, looked back at it, or looked at it, put it back, locked the door, went about his day's business. That went on every day for 2 years. Finally, he was transferred. And his aides and secretaries sitting around and seeing this little routine every morning. And they were dying of curiosity what was on that piece of paper. So they got a key, unlocked the drawer, and sure enough, there it was. And on that piece of paper were just six words. Port is left, starboard is right. Now, if you're in the Navy, it's a good thing to remember that port means left and starboard means right. Especially if you're an admiral, you ought to have that clear. Well, I thought I'd like to see every navigator, and I'd like to see every person sitting right here, Glen Eric crew, every morning just take out a piece of paper and say, harvest is plentiful, laborers are few. Harvest are plentiful, it's plentiful, laborers are few. That's why we're in business. Now, Jesus put his focus then on the laborers. He said, that's the problem. The laborers are few. So what we're in existence for, all the millions of dollars that's being spent every year, and we talk about 77 countries, 3,000 staff, it's all boiled down to two words. It's to multiply laborers. And what are laborers? They do something about the harvest. They help the helpless. And now, this would have been the other seminar on laboring. But I felt I wanted to go this route this morning. But I want to say on that, I've been asking the Lord to let me touch a life a day. And there I am up on that third floor of that, what is that building again? National Services Center. NSC. I can remember that, can I? I better write it down. But how can you do that? But you know, more days than not, it happens. Because that's part of my prayer each morning, when I pray through the day forward. That I might have a word for Jesus, or from the word, just a word, a sentence, here or there, to somebody in need. And when I pray about it, then my radar comes alive, and then just through the day, I just keep alert. I do what I normally was going to do, but I see a need that I wouldn't have seen if I hadn't prayed about it. So the bottom line has to do with the harvest and laborers for that harvest. So when we talk about Glen Eric being a cave of Adullam, where everybody that's in debt, distressed, discontented comes, but out goes mighty men and women, we're thinking mighty men and women for the harvest. Now, how can Glen Eric contribute to multiplying laborers for the harvest? I'd like you to list, each one of you, three ways out of your head that Glen Eric can contribute to that thing that Jesus told us to do, that the need was laborers. What are three things that we could do to help with that? words, what is a need that you see in helping accomplish that aim? That we could do here at Glen Eyrie. That you could do here in Glen Eyrie. Okay, now I'd like you to do, we're going to form ourselves into ad hoc little groups of three or four, and you just have to figure out how to do that. Just turn your chair around and get with somebody. And share with each other what came to your mind. And then from that, somebody will say this, oh yeah, I could put that down. Yeah, that's a good thought. And I'd like that each group then would come up with a consensus. Say, well, our group seems to agree on this one thing for sure, or these two, or these three. As our part of our vision for Glen Eyrie, that we see this place fulfilling, helping to fulfill this thing of multiplying labors and doing it in every nation of the world. Okay, so you got the instruction. I want you to share. Then I'm going to ask the groups to say what came through as sort of unanimity, one item or two or three. So I kind of get a little feel from you what you see happening at Glen Eyrie that relates to multiplying labors for the harvest and helping to do that in every nation in the world. Okay? So just ad hoc groups here. All three or four. If it gets much bigger, it'll take too much time. And you've got about 8 minutes. You and your groups see, is there any one thing? You got a lot of ideas, I'm sure. Talk. Is there any one thing for now that sort of stood out in your group above others? Sort of a consensus on as a vision as you see it for this place in accomplishing that goal? Because that's all we'll have time to share for. So do that now. I hope you've got something there. Let's share a bit. Okay, we'll start with this group right here. Who's going to be the spokesman for it? You're the spokesman. Okay, what came out of your group? I realize it's only 8 minutes, but what came out as sort of a consensus, a standout?
I'll make it as fuzzy as possible. We feel that it's a renewal. this place is renewal for both guests and staff here, renewal in the area of clarifying their goals in reaching the lost and making disciples.
Okay. Clarification and commitment to those, whatever those things come out.
Yeah, so that covers all. It covers LDI, it covers guests coming in and outreach.
Good. Good. All right. Let's see. Now, there was, but you, Doug?
Yeah. We just
saw Glenn's
contributing to multiple laborers, just in the idea of building lifetime laborers. And equipping, encouraging, and extending these folks out, kind of the process that goes on here in Glen through the conferences and through the LDI, idea of equipping, encouraging, and extending.
Mm-hmm. Building lifetime laborers, or I say, building in their lives such things as which will enable them to labor for a lifetime. Is that
right?
Sort of capture it? Laborers. I'll just put down here my own prejudice on the subject, Romans 15:14, which has to do with character, knowledge, and skill. I think character is number one, knowledge of God through knowing Christ and His Word, number two, and then skills, number three. But the big one, and in our day and age, what we need so much is character and convictions that are going to carry you through. I keep hearing it said that not many end well, few end well. I've been finding a lot that end well, but those who end well are those who've lived well. And if you don't live well, you won't end well. It doesn't start after you're 60, determine how you're going to end. It starts when you're 40, 30, how you're going to end. That has to do with character. Whether or not there are termites eating away inside that nobody sees, and the pressure comes in the 40s, you collapse. That isn't where the problem started. It started with undealt with sin in the 20s. That's my own prejudice. Let's see. So you represented that whole cluster back there, right? Who represents this cluster right here? You, okay?
We were real faithful to tradition because we came up with evangelize, establish, and equip.
Oh, I like those E's, yes.
Primarily, there were three targets, the LDI students, the staff, and the conferees, and the bulk of the things fell under basically just establishing by teaching all of those people how to get fed first before they start feeding others, and to develop relational skills just as they work here with under the pressurized environment,
uh-huh.
Learn how to be reconciled one to another, and to be, just to begin to understand the Christian life in terms of what is it, the what, why, and how of that Christian life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the next group. Who's the spokesman? You are? All right, Mike?
Well, I would, our group would concur with what Randy said, and that we felt like encouraging the management staff through continued education and giving us all that opportunity to interact with one another, thus allowing us to be fed.
All right. And LDI and the staff are the two entities that work here with the little. Okay. Who is the next group? Yes.
Picking up on the first from there a little bit, the renewal place idea.
Yes.
Ministering to those who come here as guests, where we use words like to challenge, help, and equip them. So people.
All right.
Right on the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Challenge, equip. So we do, someone else mentioned it, it's not just guests that need ministering to you, but it's also we need to minister to one another. So going along with what Randy put there, LDI, staff, and conferees, we concur, and just felt like that we wanted to keep in mind that ultimately we want to know and love the Lord of the harvest and pick up His vision. Not fall in love with His vision and then tack on Bible study, prayer, and character.
Mm-hmm. Okay, who else had a group that we didn't call on?
Us.
All right.
We go along with number three as well. not that staff and LDI need to have more time together interacting, that we can grow together, that we can minister other people to each other and to other people to guests that come in. So that's exactly where we were at.
Well, my own prejudice goes along with what you have up here. I view Glen Eyrie, have and still do, as a place to train, if you want to call it, young people in the context of serving whatever else is going on around here. But that the essence of it has to do with the development, the character, the knowledge of God, the relations relating with each other, all that goes into the sacrifice of serving other people, both on the part of the LDI and the staff, in the context of serving others. See, I've come to the conclusion that Mark 3:14 is probably the key passage on equipping. How he ordained 12 that they should be with him and that he might send them forth to preach. He didn't ordain 12 and then divide up his ministry 12 different ways and assign 1/12 to Peter, 1/12 to John. He involved them in what he was already doing and all the pressures and all the everything that went into that. It was in that context that they got their base. Then later they went out. It's the Cave of Adullam thing, a little different idea, where they gathered together all these people and then later they went out. You don't necessarily do the battle. I don't really think that you should try to train businessmen how to reach a businessman in office due to Glen Eyrie. I think we ought to do that in Dallas. But that comes to my next prejudice. I feel that this should be a retreat center, a renewal place where people come to meet God, get their vision clear.